Hello and welcome to The Bulletin with UBS on Monocle 24. Each week we hear from the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance, taking you beyond the numbers and the hype and getting to the heart of the big issues of the day. Now, if you're a regular listener to this show, you'll be well aware that UBS is interested in addressing the big questions that shape our world. To help best answer them, they sought out a number of Nobel laureates in the economic sciences to ask them to share insights, discuss their research, and open their ever-inquiring minds. This week we're hearing from one such, Bengt Holmström, winner of the Nobel Prize in 2016 for his work on contract theory and the potential pitfalls of contract design. Today, amongst other things, he discusses his more recent work on the stability of financial markets and why, despite plenty of evidence to the contrary, he retains an optimistic view on the direction the world is headed. Bengt Holmström, welcome to The Bulletin with UBS. It's great to have you with us today. Bengt, let's start by talking a little about the stability of financial markets. If we go back 10 years to 2008, did what happened then? Did that change your big picture perspective? Did it change the way that you looked at problems you've been wrestling with for a number of years? Or in a sense, I guess, did it conform to certain expectations, understandings that you had? Was it something that revolutionized anything in your approach, or it didn't affect the way that you look at the world economically, I suppose?
I think it changed everybody's mind, every economist's mind, but even the public and so on. It has been a traumatic event in many ways, and at the same time for economists, of course, also an interesting event. Why did it happen? It's safe to say nobody expected it to happen in the US. I don't know that they even thought it would happen in the Europe. Financial crisis, of course, has happened around the world all the time. But 70 years without a real big financial crisis in the U.S. suggested that we'll never have one. And it was a real wake-up call that it happened. And so in that sense, it did change my research considerably. I had been working on financial crisis issues since Finland had a financial crisis. In fact, Scandinavia and had one in 1991, 92. And that sort of piqued my interest, because my field is contract theory, as it's called, but it's also about organizations and structures. Contract theory is a very broad field. And this involves a lot about contracts. You know, debt contracts are very central to the financial crisis.
But just to pick up on that point you made about Finland, of course, you're born in Helsinki. Do you think that you have a Finnish sensibility, a particular Finnish perspective? Is there such a thing?
It's hard to look from inside and say what's special about Finns. There are all sorts of stereotypes, but I'm unusual, maybe in the sense I'm a Swedish-speaking Finn, so we are only less than 300,000 people in Finland, and moreover, my background is actually very mixed. So I don't think of myself in sort of a genetic sense as very Finnish, but culturally, I think, yes, Finland, we all feel, you know, home country always influence you a lot. I am still just Finnish after 40 years in the U.S.
And it must have made it handy at the Nobel presentation ceremony, I guess, if you're a Swedish speaker. You could understand everything
more easily. Yes, I understood at least what they said. It was very glamorous and it was hard to absorb everything, but it was a lot of fun too.
Well, let's talk a bit more about some of the issues that we began by talking about 2008. There's been a great deal of discussion about transparency and regulatory issues in the aftermath of that. I know this is something that you've written about and talked about often. And you mentioned debt a moment ago. And there's an interesting sort of, I don't know, it's not really paradoxical, but this idea that actually certain markets, you know, they're not like the stock market, for example, that requires this kind of complete transparency, a level playing field. Some areas in finance require almost some smoke and mirrors, some obfuscation. Can you tell us a bit about that and how, I don't know, has the public misunderstood that and what that means?
One way to explain this is, you know, Big Short has been a big hit, and if one really condenses the book and the movie into one sentence, it is, you know, why didn't Wall Street know anything? Why didn't they ask any questions? And the answer that comes out in the movie and the book is that, well, they were just blind in some sense, and they were off. And these five, you know, rather unique characters did a few trips to Florida and realized that this is all going to hell. And so people walk out with the feeling that, gosh, you know, Wall Street was really stupid or ignorant or maybe collusive or drugged or whatever. I think that's a grand misunderstanding of the situation. There was some of that, but one has to understand that debt markets, or money markets especially, money markets are short-term debt, you know, less than a year, but a lot of it is actually just overnight debt. Debt markets are very information insensitive when they work well. So the whole idea in some sense is that money markets are instruments where you don't have to ask questions. You are using money every day. I mean, the idea is you don't have to ask why is he giving me money or why is he paying me back in money and so on. We are transacting money basically trusting that it is what it's said to be. So it's similarly money markets that are repo markets and other markets. They are designed by over-collateralization. That's the key instrument. They are just designed so that even if you knew something, it doesn't really matter because they are so safe, their assets, that you don't have to ask any questions. And that's the whole idea. So that's when occasionally it happens that they collapse, basically because private money rather than government money is issued, that is government-backed money is issued in excess, and then people at some moment realize that somebody, they may not be backed up in the amount, so that you build sort of a house on a too narrow base. And that's why they are very traumatic, because you get this shift from not having to know anything to suddenly realize it's not $100, it's not $100, or a debt instrument of $100, it's not $100. But what is it then? Because there hasn't been any price discovery in the real sense. You know, they have a price, and there are some what we call haircuts and so on to sort of make it really safe. Haircut means that there's a buffer. But we don't have, you know, the idea is not to price exactly a collateral or anything like that. Because debt is, when it's in the money, so to speak, then it's very insensitive.
Well, I wonder about that. If there is this sort of limited information available, and that's part of its function, and I guess there's an absence or a lack of incentives to fear crisis points, to fear panics, because, again, that's functional. How do you then address the risk?
The purpose is to sort of save on information costs. It's very expensive to find out. If you look at stock markets, they are incredibly expensive to run. There are literally hundreds of people studying it. Billions are put into, you know, trying to find out the minute detail of a lot of different companies. You know, there are tens and tens of analysts studying even just a single company, like, say, Apple or something like that. So they spend a lot of money to try to figure out what is Apple worth. And we call it price discovery. So it's the best every day at almost every minute. It's sort of the best information is in the price already. And the debt contract's logic is just the opposite in some sense. Let's not have to find out what the debt of Apple is worth. You know, we are going to just price it based on something else. And then when we go really to information sensitive contracts are repos. That's even more so. Repo is a short-term overnight loan. So it's like a pawn shop is a good analogy of what repo is. And the fact that it's set up that way, and then when it collapses for some reason, you suddenly have to sell it. You know, you have to sort of find the price by either selling it or trying to, in some other way, finding the price. That's very traumatic. As I said, then the other part of it is if it really becomes epidemic, then we have to sort of out of nowhere suddenly create some kind of price discovery market to figure out what these things are worth. And that's where danger is, you know, that as we make this information insensitive and very few people or the government may be finding out or some people find out values, but most people that are trading them don't have to find out value because they just trust that it's safe. Then the risk is that it builds up at some tail, you know, somewhere. The risk has to go somewhere. So, you know, it goes into some part of the system that is very hard to find out. But on the whole, it happens. I want to emphasize that when it works, it happens rarely. And so 70 years without a financial crisis, if you give me 70 new next years without a financial crisis, I take it on a spur of the moment. So in that sense, it's very naive to say, though, how was it so terrible? If it was great for 70 years, you know, that's a long time. And of course, this was traumatic. I don't want to dismiss that. But one has to see that it has served a very good purpose for very long. And if you look at look at the role of debt, not equity. Equity has played very little role sort of historically across especially developing countries. Everything is about debt because it's so cheap. And it's just fabulously influential and important for growth. You know, without debt, it's very hard to see how you have growth. So that's the instrument of choice. I don't want to say that that's unimportant, but it's sort of, it's the smaller piece of the pie, clearly.
If we just look back at the history of your work, Bent, you were writing about moral hazard, if we go back to sort of late 70s and early 80s. And it's interesting because, you know, we had mortgage securitization happening in the early 1980s in the US. And even though you've explained this to a degree already, why it's not a relevant question, but there was a sense that perhaps some of these things were understood to be implicit in the system. And your writings did detail that. Do you think to a degree the excesses of it or the worst elements of it could have been mitigated against had people engaged more? I don't know, perhaps read some of your early works from that period a little more closely? Or is that unfair because the big picture is as you've already described it?
I would say it's not where the action was. This I don't think this happened because there was a big moral hazard problem, though such theories exist also. There was moral hazard in the sense that people were leaning on the fact that the government usually bail things out. Because the only way to get out of financial crisis in the end is for some very wealthy party to recapitalize things. And the only really wealthy party is the government. And if the government doesn't have it, you have really big problems like you see in Latin America and so on. So the U.S. exemplified, and Europe also exemplified, how the government eventually stepped in and in a sense, backed the relevant parts out. When things go wrong, that's usually where the incentive problems really become big, in the sense that people don't like to get caught having made a mistake, so they cover up or they double down or they try to get out of a situation without anybody observing. So there's a lot of the sort of wrongdoing that you see happens in situations where people realize they have made a mistake. So that's my general view of these kind of incentives. It's not that they go in there thinking I'm really going to, you know, cheat on people or otherwise in a massive way. They think something is reasonable and then they are found out to be wrong. And people don't like to be found out as wrong. They don't go there and say that I made a mistake. The world would be a lot better, by the way, if they did. And most of the time they actually do escape. That is, they correct things, they double down, they get out of the trouble and so on. So it's not an irrational thing to try. That's how I see it in the connection of the financial crisis. Then it's a very different thing if you talk about moral hazard or incentive problems in everyday life or in organizations, schools. Incentive problems are endemic.
Just to that point about, well, I guess a demographic who aren't particularly good at admitting they've made mistakes and certainly don't like to be seen to have made them, and that's the sort of political classes. And I was struck by some comments I thought you made relatively recently about this sort of need from the public, and maybe this is as a result of what happened in 2008 and the decades since, to have greater, not just transparency, but simplicity in terms of explanations of things. And you've talked really interestingly about the dangers implicit in compelling politicians to oversimplify. And I guess if we look around the world, we've mentioned the US, you've got a simplifier in chief, probably because he doesn't have the facility to do any better. But that's another story. Why is that so risky as you see it? And we're not expecting people to drill down into the theory. The layperson doesn't need to, couldn't probably understand highly complex matters. But there is a real drive towards probably oversimplification. Why do you think that's such a problem?
Well, this relates to the sort of polarization politics that we see today. People are frustrated with the representatives. And the way the democracy or representative democracy was thought to work is that it would be, again, an information cost. It would be very expensive for me to be informed about things. So I elect you because you have similar preferences to mine. And in a sense, you are my agent or my representative, as it said. You know, we are not always aligned, but, you know, I sort of trust you to have the same taste as I do. And you will find out information, you meaning, you know, some of these few hundred people that are actually representatives. And they have a whole machinery for finding things out so that the whole public doesn't have to find out. So that's the logic of how the system is supposed to work, and it's sensible. What is happening now is that, you know, things went wrong. I think a lot has to do with the world having gotten very quickly rather complex with regard to globalization and new technologies and other things. So the representatives had more on their plate, more and more on their plate, that, you know, it was difficult. It wasn't like the old simple days, say, when you had just a few issues on the table per day or something, that you are sort of overwhelmed by the decisions to some extent. I think they had an information problem probably also. And one looks at their desks and so on, one realizes that they really have a lot to do. So in any way, one way or another, they were blamed for the crisis, you know, the globalization, the loss of jobs, everything was blamed on these representatives as something, and with the suspicion that, you know, some of them were not up to the task and so on. I think the reality is nobody is really up to the task. And so what has happened in a lot of countries, and you've seen it here in the UK, you see it in Finland, you saw it, we see it in the US, you know, they just want everybody basically to be changed. All the people are new. And if you don't have any experience, all the better. You know, you are not one of these corrupt people. I would say that the corruption blame comes partly from, you know, this. They try perhaps in some instances to cover up or make themselves look good. Because after all, the audience they are performing for and what they want is to be re-elected, and the audience is the voters. So that's the way I see this system. And the breakdown comes, I think, or the sort of transparency issue that you alluded to, is a response people think they should make. They should say, let us just get more information. So they are going away from the basic principle. But they have, I think, the naive belief that if they get, you know, a lot of information, somehow they will then know what's happening and so on. But there's such a mass of information, the context and everything they need to know in order to sort of have an informed opinion about these things. So it's like, you know, they suddenly want to sit in the driver's seat and decide things. And that, I think, aggravates this problem. So now you are being scrutinized as a politician more and more closely. This transparency brings you sort of everything you do gets scrutinized. And it is in that situation that it's very difficult for you to make compromises, for instance, with the other side of the political spectrum, the way they used to do. So, you know, a lot was about compromise. You know, actually governance is about making compromises even with people that you strongly disagree with. But today, the public is basically electing people that are not, they just want people that don't make compromises because they somehow, they are under grand suspicion, the whole representative layer. And that's the biggest danger of that is that the people cannot, after all, directly, you know, the direct democracy is not going to work. And so they, then powerful people become basically variants of dictators. Or, you know, their power increases. The leaders, like the president's powers increase. I see it as a systemic breakdown. Whether it will repair itself naturally, as I hope, or whether it will end up the way it has ended up many times before. Revolutions, wars, or that resets the system, you know, eventually. Because people realize that that's not a good alternative either. But I don't think this road that we are on right now is necessarily the right one, or then we have to, there's something to be discovered. Mm. There are certain things where the public needs to be, the opinion of publics is important. Things that I would say on the whole, my thinking is that if they don't have to think about the problem, it's a moral issue or you know, something where you don't have to analyze a lot of data to have an opinion that this is right or wrong. You know, so in those issues, you can go to the public because then they don't need, in some sense, information. We are talking about something where they have their gut feeling or their strong feelings. It doesn't get any better by analyzing it. Those, I think, are good for referenda. Issues where they actually need a lot of analysis, potentially, those are very dangerous for them because they don't have the information and then the public may be, all of them may be highly correlated. The analysis, for instance, they are looking at the same information. It's not the wisdom of the crowds because it's based on just the same data and they don't realize it's the same data, a small point. And in that case, it's dangerous. So Brexit would be an example where I think partly there were issues that were sort of gut feel issues, like maybe immigration might be, you know, or how much does Europe have to say about how free are we sort of to do what we want. You know, it's kind of a structural thing. And the UK historically has had its own way in some sense. If you look at the long history, it's been an independent country. And so I think that gut feeling played a role. Then, on the other hand, when you start studying, you know, how expensive or what are the sort of economic values and so on, I don't think the public had any idea of, you know, what it might cost or what the benefits and costs are. I don't know that the politicians knew that well either. And, you know, a lot of people have woken up and wondered, is this the right or the wrong thing? And I don't have the answer, you know.
I was hoping maybe you had an answer to that.
I am hesitant to go and say that they should or shouldn't do what, you know, this is, UK is not my country. I think it was conducted under very low information situations, and there were issues where information mattered. So I do think that this is going to be a lot more expensive than the public thought at the time they did it. Doesn't mean that they won't be able to get out of it.
Well, they'll find a way.
Yeah, find, but I'm saying, I mean, yes, the UK has been, it's one of those countries that have been resilient in some sense, and, you know, it has come out of very complicated situations before. So I sort of am, in that sense, optimistic.
Well, just, it's funny you mentioned that then. Are you broadly optimistic? I sense from all of our conversations so far that you are broadly optimistic about the path the world is on. And we've touched on a couple of themes, political populism we've mentioned, disinformation or misinformation, a public that's demanding one thing that may be to its own detriment and this sort of thing. Despite those challenges, do you retain an optimistic view of where we're headed? You know, we began again by talking about financial crisis in the context of, what, 7-8 decades without one. Do we sometimes need to ourselves go back to the information and say, look, you know, things aren't so bad and we're not on a road somewhere negative? Do you retain an optimistic view of view of things?
I think in every human there is a sort of built-in optimism. You know, I'm sort of an optimistic pessimist or something like that. I'm worried about the way things are going, but I'm hopeful that they somehow will sort themselves out. Fundamentally, it may be what has happened is there has been just too rapidly a globalization coming, a too rapid shift in technology in a way that has really, really shaken the structure of family, structure of community, structure of companies. You know, it's sort of a real shake-up in a very short time. And I think ultimately that is absorbing that shift has been very difficult on all sorts of levels. At the same time, I think this technology will be one that, for better or worse, I think this will be the one that also will solve the crisis. So it's in the big historical picture, these are disruptive times, but in the end, they have become better. To end on an optimistic note, you know, Hans Rosling, who just died, who was a famous, he was big on YouTube and really worth watching him. So he has just been data showed, you know, how much better the world really is. And in his view, there are no really poor countries anymore, even by certain metrics. But if you just look at China or something like that, 400 million people out of poverty in 30, 40 years, I mean, it's an incredible achievement that we never thought would be possible. There have been diseases eradicated in much faster time than we thought. And so a lot of kind of hard facts of that sort are good. We live healthier lives, you know, we have a lot more freedom and so on. Somehow the paradox is that it doesn't make people necessarily happier.
But that's perhaps a topic for another day.
Yes.
Thanks. Thanks so much for speaking to us. Really great to hear from you. Thanks for your time today.
Thank you.
Wonderful indeed to hear from Bengt Holmstrom on this 221st edition of the Bulletin with UBS on Monocle 24. To read more from and about Bengt Holmstrom and to discover how Nobel perspectives shape the UBS worldview, head to ubs.com and search Nobel Perspectives. The Bulletin with UBS on Monocle 24.